Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome back to the Intercooler podcast, everybody. And this week, we're sort of, we're out of our comfort zone, I would say. Andrew, I know that before we get going, you want to hang a big disclaimer off the front of this episode.
Honestly, by the time we're done with this, I will have never spent a greater amount of my life talking about a subject about which I know precisely nothing than I'm about to. I don't know why we're going to do it. I'll tell you why we're going to do this. So we're going to talk about motorbikes, aren't we? Neither of us has a bike license. I don't think either of us has ever had a bike license. We're not bikers. But I think, okay, so I think the slightly serious point behind it is I think that there will be many people listening to this who are the same as us. People who, just because we don't have bike licenses, don't mean we're not interested in bikes. It doesn't mean that there aren't other circumstances in which we would have gone down that road. And I think there are an awful lot of people who have, you know, for many, many years toyed with that idea. I certainly have. I've wrestled with it at times. I've come really, really close at times, but I've never quite gone through with it. So we're going to talk about, I mean, this is going to be the ultimate sort of layman's chat, isn't it? But hopefully it'll be interesting, and we'll talk a bit about, you know, the vicarious experiences that we've had, the places that we've gone, and yeah, see where it takes us.
Yeah, this is Car Guys talking about motorbikes, so I'm sorry
to all the... What could possibly go wrong?
Apologies to all the proper bikers out there. We're going to mangle all this, I'm afraid, and we're going to get plenty wrong. But hopefully it'll be... I don't know, maybe it'll be an interesting perspective. We'll see. So I suppose one of the reasons I want to talk about bikes is that I am curious about them. I don't think I will ever get my license, although who knows. But I, you know, if you love cars and you love mechanical engineering and you love motorsport, it's almost impossible not to be sort of drawn to motorcycles in some way, isn't it? Because they look extraordinary. The performance is sensational, and everyone I talk to, they tell me that they're actually way more exciting to ride than cars are to drive. And also, I watch a reasonable amount of MotoGP, for instance. And there are times where you're leaping off the sofa going, oh yeah, my God, I can't believe this is happening.
Yeah. So they've got no downforce.
Because they've got no downforce, and they're skinny. Yeah. And there are lots of lines through corners.
But also, you know, just going back to what you were saying about, you know, we shouldn't be surprised by this because, you know, you and I bang on about what's important to us in a car. And we're always going on about, you know, back to basics, simple, lightweight, you know, compact dimensions, all these sort of things. Well, if you take that idea and run with it, you end up with a motorbike. So really, they should be the things that we love the most. They are the purest form of mechanized transport, aren't they? And, you know, I love, and I always have loved the idea of motorbikes. In fact, when I was a kid, when I was a kid, I suppose, when I was like sort of 10, 11, 12, I went through a phase. So this is in the mid-70s. When I was genuine, this is when all the Japanese superbikes were starting to come up. And motorbikes took, you know, a big, you know, the biggest step I suspect they've ever made, from the slightly sort of clunky machines they used to be to these beautifully built machines with these, you know, with these twin cam four cylinder engines and so on. And I became really, really interested in them. And then I would have told you that if I was ever going to earn a living out of doing anything, it would have been about bikes rather than cars. But then stuff happens, and it didn't happen. And there's still a part of me that wonders what would have happened if it had. I probably wouldn't be here to have this conversation, to be honest, but, you know, that's another story.
Well, we'll come on to that. I mean, there are so many reasons to be curious about them. I like the fact that, relative to a car, certainly, you can buy one for a few thousand pounds, and it can be an exquisite machine, beautifully engineered, and that can be your pride and joy. That can be the thing that you look forward to maintaining on the weekend, to riding on the weekend. You can really adore that thing that you own, and it costs a few grand and relatively little to run, I suppose. And that's, I just find that really interesting. It's actually not about performance for me. That, you know, a really quick super bike is just unbelievably, you sometimes see them tearing off down a motorway slipway or something, don't you? And you just think, my God, look at that thing go. It's not the performance that I'm drawn to, really, because even a sort of mid-ranking sports car is too fast for the road, isn't it? Never mind something with more than supercar performance. But I suppose the other thing is that if I did have a bike and a bike license, I wouldn't commute on it. That's not what I would do. It would be, I'd be a proper fair weather rider, and it would be a total recreation thing for me, so that there would be no overlap whatsoever with the time that I spend on the road otherwise, motorway journeys, commuting, driving through town, so that when I was on my motorcycle of an evening or at the weekend, it would feel, I'm sure, like this sort of a special time, me time, and it would be unlike anything else that I did the rest of that week. So
can I ask you two questions about that?
Go on.
Question one is, if you only use your bike purely recreationally, are you not missing out on, frankly, the purpose of a bike, which is to just guarantee you an arrival time because traffic jams don't exist? Yeah. And for all of us, and you and I have probably done it more than most, I mean, you just sat there steaming in the traffic because some idiot stuck it in the wall or whatever. And all these bikes have just come cruising past you. How many times have you sat there thinking, oh my goodness, I'd give anything right now for a bike license? And the second question is, you say, and I think I'm asking myself this question as much as I'm asking you. You say that you wouldn't be interested in the performance, but this is nevertheless something you're going to use purely recreationally, yeah? So you're out there, you know, you live pretty close as I do to Welsh mountains, and that's the sort of place you're going to go on your whatever it is that you go and get. And, you know, the road is, you know, winding away in front of you in your sports bike, and you're just going to sit there and just go, well, I'm just going to tootle. I'm going to look at the sheep over there. I'm going to have a nice time. Look at the view. I don't believe it. And one of the reasons I don't have a bike is because I just don't trust myself. I don't trust myself to ride it within my talents. I suspect I'd be a pretty average bike rider. But and my enthusiasm would so massively outstrip my talent. Sooner or later, you know, I would find myself in a situation where, were I in a car, it might be oversteering a bit, might be understeering a bit, and there are certain things that you can do to sort that out and all will be well. In a bike, you're in hospital, at best. You know, and you and I, well, I mean, we'll probably get onto that as well, but, you know, you and I, you know people who have been in situations, many, probably most, not of their own creation. And that's the other thing, where you've just got nowhere to go. And it scares me. So the question is, are you not missing out on the point of a bike? And do you trust yourself not to go nuts at the weekend?
Well, with both, there's a theory and a reality, isn't there? So, yeah, I suspect that if you had a bike sitting at home and you found yourself in a traffic jam, at some point you're going to go, oh, sod it, I'm taking the bike next time. And I'm sure you would. I'm sure you would start commuting on it. In practice. And then, yeah, okay, the performance. That's not what I find seductive about motorcycles. But again, of course, once you're on one and the road opens up ahead of you and there's great visibility and it's dry and warm, what are you going to do? You're going to give it
and
some tap.
And you've got a great motor underneath you, which you know will get a 14,500 RPM.
Yeah.
Are you not going to let it go?
Yeah. Well, I think you probably would. It's interesting that you said you couldn't trust yourself? Because I hear that quite a lot, and I actually think I could trust myself. Like, if I'm in a really fast car, I can restrain myself. I don't feel like I have to unleash it all the time. And I think probably on the bike,
not all the time. You know, all the time.
No,
the
point. No,
you only have to do it once for it to all go horribly wrong.
Yeah,
you only have to run out of talent once.
Well, and this is, there we go. We're into it now. That's probably why I've never done it. And will I ever do it? I don't know. I'm mid-30s now. I suspect there'll be a bit of research out there that says your chances of ever setting off on the bike license journey just does that after your 35th birthday or something. When you've got a family, or when that self-preservation instinct begins to sort of grow within you. I don't know. I do wish, actually, that as a four-year-old kid, I'd been stuck on one of those little scrambler things that you see little children on sometimes, just pookling around a garden somewhere. Because lots of rally drivers, lots of racing drivers, they started off on two wheels as little kids, and it gives them a control and a confidence with machinery that
you just get that innate sense of balance, don't you? Yeah,
you do.
I mean, you do. I did ride bikes. It's not as if I've never ridden bikes. I rode bikes when I was a teenager, completely illegally. I had a
What's the statute of limitations? It's up.
Yeah, well, yeah, probably. I wasn't even in this country at the time. I had a mate called Ben, who was a really good biker. In fact, I don't think he ever came off. And he had a thing called a Honda VT250F. And this had, it was a V-twin. Even if you go and look at one now, and I do still do this occasionally, and given that this would have been, oh, blimey, early 80s, it's still a really cool looking bike. I used to go everywhere on that. He just got up, and I just go roaming off around wherever I was on this thing, complete uninsured, unlicensed, unethicked. and nothing ever went wrong, thank goodness. But then stuff started to happen, and you know, not to me, thank goodness, but to others. And I just kind of got scared. And I've been scared ever since, which is why. And also, the other point to make is, you know, you think that you getting on a bike is a bad idea. You know, you're 34, I'm 55. Me getting on a, I mean, I think that if you were to do some kind of chart of the people most likely to have a really bad accident on a motorbike, a 55-year-old bloke who hasn't really ridden motorbikes at all and has never had a bike license is probably going to be the person who is most likely to have that accident. I really do believe that. Where I live in the Wye Valley, very sadly, in fact, we had one last weekend, fatalities on bikes. And I don't know the particular circumstances of that. What I do know is it was a bloke on the bike and he was 54 years old. And they're just, you know, it doesn't seem to me to be, you know, young lads in their 20s or whatever doing this. It just seems to be middle-aged men, you know, having some kind of sad midlife crisis and thinking, well, I need to go and get on a bike. And that is absolutely, that is another fantastically good reason why I should never ever try and ride a motorcycle.
Okay, so do you, are you remotely tempted, or is that gone now?
Colin Goodwin, who will be known to lots of people listening to this and will hopefully soon become even better known to people who subscribe to the Intercooler app, as he is our incoming agony uncle. I mean, he's been a biker all his life. I mean, before he was a motoring journalist, he was a dispatch rider. And he's raced bikes. He'd never be without a bike in his life. And he has tried for a period of, you know, genuinely 30 years to persuade me to get on a bike. And actually, about 3 years ago, I got very, very close. I genuinely got very close, because my children were of an age where, you know, they were a bit more grown up. They were sort of in their late teens and going off to university and that sort of thing. And I kind of thought, well, if not now, then when? And then our friend Henry Hope Frost died on a motorcycle in an accident entirely not of his creation. And that did it for me. That was, you know, if you don't listen to that, I mean, Henry was an extremely experienced biker, a very good and accomplished biker. Henry is also, you know, at the time of his accident, a lot younger than I am. I think he was 47. And I'm just a bloody idiot. And if you are so stupid that you that an event that happens like that to a very close friend of yours and you don't take that on board, then I'm not going to say you deserve what's coming to you, but you know, well, you're an idiot. And so I think that Henry's accident really did do it for me. And certainly, even if I was stupid enough to want to do it, I think my family, in the context of that, would have. I mean, you know, my missus, for instance, she is an amazing woman. She has let me go off and do all sorts of stupid stuff. You know, racing Edwardian cars at Goodwood probably isn't a very sensible way to pass it. And she's never batted an eyelid at any of it. But I think if I said to her, "I'm going to go and get a bike license," I don't. She wouldn't say, "No, you're not, chum." She would say something like, "Well, your call, your choice entirely. I will support you, but you know, if you're asking me for my opinion, I don't think it's a great idea. I'd rather you didn't." Mm. Absolutely right.
I'd get something very similar from my other half, I'm sure. Yeah, I mean, Henry's case is a very serious one, isn't it? And it's a reminder that even if you can trust yourself on a bike not to take liberties, it doesn't matter because you are still vulnerable, and it just takes one other idiot in a car to pull out on you or something, and the worst could happen. I've ridden on the back of a motorbike once ever, and the journey was 1 mile. My mate Shippy, he's a biker, he's an accomplished rider, and he just gave me a ride home one day, literally a mile home. And as we were riding along a road at 30, we came up to a junction and a car pulled out on us, and he had to get so hard on the brakes that even with me on the back wheel just about lifted off. And actually, we didn't really come that close to hitting the car. But if we'd been going a bit quicker, if the car pulled out a bit later,
horrendous,
just like that, I'd be off. And who knows what happens? Even at 30 miles an hour, if you come off, you're going to hurt yourself.
It's going to hurt. And you know, you're absolutely, you know, if I think back, and I'm not going to dwell on this stuff, but there was Henry's accident. There was a bloke I knew, you know, it doesn't even have to be an idiot. There was a bloke I knew who was riding very slowly in the rush hour around some square in London. And it was raining and something had left a patch of diesel or something on the road. And he just lost the front tire, came off the bike, as far as anybody can tell, landed on his bum in the road, not a mark on him, run over by the car behind. There was a chap I knew when I was a kid. One of my father's great friend's sons was killed on a bike. Another bloke I knew lost an arm on a bike. My brother, my oldest brother, who is fine, but he had a really bad bike accident when he came around a corner and met a nurse who was coming back from the hospital having done, you know, a week of nights, and she was completely exhausted and probably wasn't quite as much on the correct side of the road as she should have been. And he went sort of bounced off the bonnet and the roof and landed on his ass in the road. And, you know, and he had, you know, he's had back problems ever since. And the one thing that all these accidents had in common was they had nothing to do with the bloke on the bike.
Mm.
And in all those accidents, if you'd been in a car, yeah, you know, at worst, it would have been a bit expensive. No one would even have been hurt. Mm.
It gives you plenty to think about, doesn't it? This podcast is not going to be about why biking is reckless or why bikers, should think about what they're up to, how they're spending their time. That's not what we're doing here. We're just sort of explaining why you and I have been so hesitant about it. I think
most bikers that I see are, you know, and I admire them. I think it's an incredibly skilled thing to do. And most of them I see, you know, when you see idiots on the road, then to me, they're very, very rarely on bikes. I think people who ride bikes well, because frankly, they know the consequence of what happens if they don't. And they're trying to minimize that risk. So I couldn't be less anti-bike. But our experiences are our experiences, and we have to tell them as we recall them.
So you said you used to ride around on bikes back in the day. And so you, I'm sure, therefore, understand the appeal and the sensation. You get
completely
what that's all about.
Completely.
real bikers will laugh at me for saying this, but I think I've had some insight into it as well, because at 16, I had a little 49cc scooter And it had a limiter on it, and it wouldn't do more than 35 miles an hour, maybe 38 if the gradient was with you. And there were times I used it for getting to and from school in sick form. So I sort of did commute on it, I suppose. And in the winter, it was horrible. And when it was raining, it was horrible. You just bury your head into your shoulders and you just sit there like this, just desperate for it to be over. However, in the summer, when it's a lovely, warm, sunny day, just got a T-shirt on, which is probably stupid. Maybe on an open road, a flowing country road, even at 35 miles an hour, with the sights and the smells and the wind rushing past you and the bike just leaning slightly through corners. It is a lovely sensation. And I can only imagine what that's like when you take away a 35 mile an hour speed limiter and, you know, you've got a more serious bike beneath you, a bit more performance. That, it must be incredible. I get why people can't help themselves. I totally do.
I recently had a scooter experience. This will be one of the most ridiculous things you've ever heard me say, okay? But it is absolutely true. I was, last year, I was very lucky, I went to Vallelunga to drive the Porsche RSR 19, so their current Le Mans car. And it was as extraordinary as you might expect. But they only had, there was one car which we could drive. There were a few journalists who were cycling through it, so there was quite a lot of downtime. And of course, I should have been writing my story and everything else, but I just noticed that there were these electric scooters that Porsche had brought, which were in the paddock. And so I just got on one of these things and just started roaming around the Vallelunga paddock on this electric scooter, which probably didn't do more than 15 miles an hour. It was hilarious. It was such good fun. And I was bombing about, and it was just... I was just really, really happy on it. I mean, having just got out of an RSR 19 and onto, which is, one of the fastest things of its type that's ever been built, and onto an electric scooter at 15 miles an hour, which is, most people probably run at 15 miles an hour or something close to it. And I don't know, it was just fun. And I just like that idea of being, I like being completely exposed. It was just nice being out there in the open with nothing around you, cocking about on a little scooter. So, yeah, I do understand exactly what you mean.
Mm. Yeah, God, I might convince myself to do something I don't want to do with this podcast. Okay, let's talk then about motorsport, bike racing, road racing.
Yeah,
We've both been to the TT only once. Tell us your story.
Again, Goodwin. Colin Goodwin. He had been badgering me for years. And because I'm not a biker and I didn't really want to, go to all that effort of schlepping up to, wherever it is you've got to go to, Liverpool, Holyhead or whatever, and then getting on the boat and, going over there and blah, blah, blah. And so I was just kind of resisting it because I kind of seen it on YouTube. So I thought, well, I know what that's like. Huh, did I? And then, Goodwin went and rather inconveniently built himself his own aircraft. And so he said, okay, so we'll fly. So you've got no excuses. It's going to take an hour and a half. Okay. It's going to, and then we were all set up 1 year and I think it got rained off or something happened. No, I think it was delayed. And then the days that we couldn't then do the days that it was back on again. So that didn't happen. And then I think 4 years ago, we finally got up there. And he flew us up, flew me up. And I have never seen anything like it. If you think you've seen the TT on YouTube, you've seen nothing. The difference between Formula One in person and Formula One on a telly is inconsequential compared to the difference in the sensation of watching for real motorcycles go around that Isle of Man course. We got there in plenty of time, and I think it was practice day for the senior TT. So, the big boys on the big bikes. And Colin said, well, I think we need to concentrate really hard on where you're going to be when you first see a bike going around the TT course. And so he said, right, bottom of Bray Hill. So when they start, the first thing they do is they go down Bray Hill. And at the bottom of Bray Hill, for those who haven't been there or seen it, there is the road goes down and it goes slightly through a curve. And into a big dip and then up the other side. And I don't know how fast they were going through there, but I suspect it's about 170. And the first bike I ever saw was John McGuinness,
the man, going through there. And it occurred to me that what I was watching was somebody controlling this machine, not as you would in a car, trying to balance, you know, understeer and oversteer, but almost, and without wishing to sound too melodramatic about it, trying to strike the balance almost between life and death, because they were so on the limit. And the bikes are doing this. They're shimmying, they're moving in two dimensions at 117, goodness knows what, when they're completely cranked over. And there is nowhere to go. And I can remember there are some traffic lights at the bottom, and they had these big blocks around them. And I went up, I can remember going up and just, you know, because you spend a lot of time waiting for stuff to come past and just sort of tapping one of these blocks. And it was rock hard. And I said to Colin, I don't understand how this is possibly going to protect a rider. And he looked at me and said, what do you mean? What makes you think it's there to protect the rider? It's there to protect the traffic light. And then suddenly I kind of saw what this event was about. And because we live, and I'm not saying this is necessarily a bad thing, but because we live in such a safety conscious world, it never even occurred to me that there was a place. And it reminded me, I guess, of, sadly I was never there, but it made me think of, you know, what it must have been like to line the route of the Mille Miglia or the Targa Florio back in the 1950s when, you know, there was the same level of safety. And I can remember after that, we went down a place called Kronky Vody, which will be very well known to anybody who knows anything about TTs. And it's basically, it's a long place, a straight piece of road, but it's got some bumps in it. And so the bikes come down and over everyone, they look in the air. And we were at the side of the road waiting for these things to come. And I just wondered how far back from the road we would need to stand, because clearly they weren't going to let us stay where we were, because we were literally on the verge at the side of the road. And we waited and we waited. We knew we were getting closer to the time when the bikes were going to start coming past. And then finally a marshal approached. And I thought, oh, this is when we get told to shove off. And he came up to us and he literally said, when the bikes come past, just make sure you keep your feet in. That was it. And so literally, these things are coming past you. I mean, they must be doing the thick end of 200. And, you know, you could just reach out and touch them. And I can remember, and this is why there's another reason why I'm in two minds about whether I'll ever go back, but I'll come to that in a minute. But I find it almost too exciting. It scared me, not so much for the ride, but the experience was so overwhelming. Every time a bike comes past, it's a shocking, startling, severe experience. And it was, to be honest with you, it was almost too much for me. And then there is, of course, the other side of it. On that particular day, very sadly, two people died. One of them, less than a minute after I'd seen him, there was a sidecar outfit, and I think the bloke in the sidecar bit died, in the accident. And we saw an awful lot of incredible stuff that day, stuff I will never, ever forget. And almost all of it was amazing. But I can remember getting on the plane and flying back to wherever it is we flew back to, and just thinking, I mean, just such a mix of emotion. On the one hand, seeing racing the way I had, as a purist, always wanted racing to be, and as someone who'd gone on about, you know, nanny states and, you know, everything becoming too safe, and I say this about, you know, the sort of racing that I do, that, you know, as long as spectators don't get involved, and as long as, you know, you're the person in the car or on the bike and you know the rules and you know the risk you're taking and you do your own free will, you should be allowed to get out there and do it. But then you actually go and see what happens, and you see someone who then has that kind of accident. And, you know, I don't think you'd be human if it didn't make you think. And I have never said I will never go back, but I haven't gone back. And I don't know if I ever would. I don't know if I will, because part of me thinks, of course, you've got to go back because it was one of the most exciting, thrilling experiences of my life. It's certainly the most exciting thing I have ever done without actually doing it myself. Yeah. It's certainly the most exciting thing I've ever witnessed. So why wouldn't you go back? Frankly, because at times it was too exciting for me. So, yeah, I'm a mix of emotions about the whole thing.
I feel completely the same way. So I've only been once to the TT. I can't remember the year, but it was the year that Mark Higgins first did a lap in the Subaru. That was the Bray Hill year where he had that terrifying incident at Bray Hill. That almost was a plane crash, but he somehow held it and carried on.
You've never seen the end car of it. Get onto YouTube and just go Mark Higgins, yeah. Bray Hill. Because nothing bad happens. That's the good thing.
No.
And also, look at the bloke in the passenger seat while he's doing it. Mm. It's just hilarious, isn't it?
It's extraordinary. Go and watch it. So I was there that year. And actually, I was lucky enough to ride with Higgins in an Impreza that year, around the full lap.
Blimey.
Not the same car. And the course wasn't closed. But of course, the mountain during TT week is one way only. And there's no speed limit anyway. So certainly over the top of the mountain, he was unbelievably fast and committed, driving so quickly with no margin for error, but at no point making anything like a mistake. It was exceptional to watch, using every millimetre of road. It was an incredible thing to witness. And after that, there is no doubt in my mind that the TT course, what is it, 37 miles or something, it is the greatest course of any type anywhere in the world.
Tell me, were you scared?
Not scared, no. Not scared. I'm a terrible passenger. But on that occasion, not scared, you know, maybe a little bit on edge, but no, not scared. That circuit is extraordinary. And so I totally understand why it's become the TT such a legendary, revered event around the world, because that circuit, the speeds they're going, just incredible. They're doing the quickest guys. I think they're at or close to 135 mile an hour average from a standing start around that place.
I think they are. Yeah.
Whoa, that's extraordinary. And so,
if you think there are actually some pretty slow corners on that course.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are some sort of like 30, 40 mile an hour corners on that course. So you
there's
think
a hairpin,
how much time
there's a hairpin
you've got to spend.
Where they're crawling around that hairpin that goes up to the mountain court, to the mountain road. It's just phenomenal. One of the things that I really love about watching the TT television footage is that you'll be riding on board with someone, going through, you know, you've got trees hanging over, maybe rushing past buildings, and you go, flipping heck, this is fast. And then another one comes by and overtakes. And you think, oh my God, how's he managed that?
Yeah.
And so like you, the first place I spectated was the bottom of Bray Hill. And much like you, by the sounds of it, I was blown away by what I was witnessing. You just can't believe how quickly they're coming through. And you're right, there's a compression at the bottom that gives them a little kick. And they bounce up and they keep going. And I watched a few bikes go through, couldn't believe what I was witnessing. And at some point, I just thought, I have to stop watching this, because it felt like someone was going to come off on that compression, hit a wall, and I was going to witness something terrible. I honestly had to walk away and just go, that's enough of that. And yeah. I've watched a lot of rallying. I've watched the Dakar, lots of Formula One, plenty of circuit racing. And I've never thought, I have to stop watching this. Not even come close, but...
No.
Yeah, the TT did it for me.
Isn't it great? Isn't it great? Because, I mean, there are people who say it's monstrous that people should be allowed to take those risks these days. Have we learned nothing? And, you know, and it is absolutely true, because of the speeds of the things, that the TT has never been more dangerous than it is now. You know, if you look at me, because it's been going on for 100 and something years, hasn't it? And, you know, very sadly, for all those factors, you know, most of the deaths have been in the more recent decades. But quite aside from the economic argument, and I think we all know what a massive economic boost to the island that it brings, I just don't think for a moment that it should be banned or it should be stopped. If people want to go out there and do that, fantastic. I have no desire. Even if I was a biker, I wouldn't. I'm not even sure I'd go and do the whole Mad Sunday thing, because I think I'd just be too scared of the idiots around me. But as an event, I hope it lasts forever. I really, really do. I just don't know if I'll ever go again.
Yeah, completely agree. It shouldn't be banned. You know, everyone who competes there they absolutely understand the risks, and they should be allowed to keep taking those risks.
Yeah, it's also interesting, isn't it? The guys who have, significant accidents, but somehow manage to recover, they always get back.
Yeah,
they always get back on the bike and have another crack at it. Because it's part of who they are. It defines them. I think that they would regard not doing the TT as as good as losing a few limbs. It's absolutely, as I say, part of their identity. It's quite interesting, isn't it? Was it someone like Valentino Rossi? There are some sort of MotoGP riders who've gone over there and looked at it and just gone, no thanks.
Amazing, isn't it? It's extraordinary. Yeah. I think it was Connor Cummings, I think it was him, who had the horrible accident on the mountain course where he just dropped off the side of the road and he was ragdolled through the air. Broken limbs.
Is that the one where there's that helicopter footage of him having it?
It's a frightening thing to watch. Horrible injuries. And even after that, he went back there and he raced again. Those guys, I'm sure, they're just wired differently. To be able to come to terms, be at peace with that level of risk and still ride flat out. Wow. There's something heroic about that. And
yeah, I agree.
We've spoken about this before. There aren't too many heroic forms of motorsport left, and unquestionably the TT is one of them.
It probably is the most dangerous. It's certainly the most raw, most visceral, exciting, thrilling form of motorsport, certainly that I've ever witnessed. I can't imagine how you, how you want to, but even how you could make it more exciting than it is. Not possible. It is the most exciting thing I've ever seen and will ever see, I'm sure.
But who are these guys and girls who willingly put themselves in those bloody sidecars and hang off them through corners at God knows what speed? That is, they might even be madder than the riders.
No, I think they are madder. I think they are the maddest of all, because at least if you're a rider, you get to choose, don't you? You get to choose your level of commitment. If you're the poor sap in the sidecar. That sort of relationship I do find very interesting, because the level of trust and understanding. You imagine trying to break in, even if you're a sidecar rider, breaking in a new rider or vice versa. And just working out, because they will all be slightly different in the way they transfer their weight and the speed at which they do it and the timing at which they do it. And just that relationship between the two of them, where two human beings basically have to operate as one. And the price of not doing so is so apocalyptically enormous. I do find that very, very interesting. There is no amount of money in the world that would get me one of those sidecars for even an 8/10 lap round there. No, I just
absolutely not interested. Oh, okay, good. Well, there we go. Car guys talking about bikes.
We'll cut this out of the podcast if there isn't an answer to it. Is there a particular bike that, out of all bikes, that if you were going to go and ride one, you'd want to ride? Is it sort of like, I don't know, whether you're a sort of sports bike Fireblade fan, or you're a touring BMW fan, or an old Japanese classic bike fan, or I don't know, is there anything which really floats your boat?
It's something to look at. I think a Ducati Panigale is just extraordinary. However, I think if I was going to ride, I'd want something a bit more sit up, upright and a bit more relaxed, because you see people getting off a Panigale and they can't walk. They're waddling to the coffee stand, aren't they? And that posture where you're hunched right over the thing, it just looks uncomfortable. I don't know. I don't know enough about maybe like a Ducati Monster, something where you're a bit more upright, but it's still a fairly sporting machine. It's
and not still a, quite back to basics and...
Yeah. Something like that.
Not a Honda Goldwing with sort of luggage.
No, I don't think I'm into that. What about you?
I guess because I went through that, as I explained earlier, I went through that phase of just being suddenly, very briefly, really, really getting into them. And then I think my brother must have had his accident, which then got me out of them quite quickly. But so the other bikes. So Kawasaki made a thing called a Z650, which was to me just like the sort of the archetypal bike of that era. So it had disc brakes and it had a four-cylinder twin cam engine, and it was just beautifully proportioned. And I also, you know, 650 is kind of, it's not insane. But then when would it, I suppose it would have been the early 80s, and this will show my complete lack of knowledge. Then they started doing six-cylinder bikes. Yeah. So Honda had the CBX, which has six cylinders right across the frame like that, you know, cylinders pouring out each side of the bike, you know, beyond the frame. And Kawasaki had a thing called a Z1300. And actually, I think that was water cooled. And I can remember seeing a Z1300 and just thinking, this job, because back then, you know, the bigger is better, isn't it? And, you know, the more cylinders and the larger the engine, then clearly the better the bike must be. Probably not. But I can remember seeing these things and just thinking, wow, that's really, really cool. So that's kind of where I, and I also have, because I know someone who's got a Vincent Black Shadow, and a Vincent Black Shadow is, as I understand it, the sort of Lamborghini Miura of bikes. It's the most beautiful, wonderful thing. And I see that. And as an object, I don't particularly want to ride it, but that's something to look at. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous piece of engineering. But the more modern stuff, you and I both know people who still ride, you know, the latest stuff. To be honest, it doesn't do it for me. I don't look at this stuff when I see them on the road and think, oh, I really, really want. I don't know why. They just don't. They're not beautiful to me. They're, you know, they're purposeful and they're impressive, but they're not beautiful machines. And I think because I have no ability to appreciate them on a dynamic level, the only way I can appreciate them is for their appearance. And really modern sports bikes don't do that for me.
Oh, fair enough. Well, we'll leave it there then for the bikes. We'll leave it there. And yeah, to those of you who do know about bikes and do ride, I'm sorry if we completely butchered it and got it all wrong. Yeah. But there we go. That's Car Guys talking about bikes. Just to finish off this podcast, though, Andrew, I want Car Guys to talk about cars, or a car. Because it wasn't that long ago that the Toyota GR86 was unveiled. And certainly, looking at the spec, it's promising, isn't it? Because, I mean, the GT86 was a brilliant thing. This one is 1,270 kilograms, so a little bit heavier, but still
not
a light
much.
Car. Yeah, a light car for a modern four-seat sports car. It's now got a 2.4-litre engine, still naturally aspirated, with another 35 horsepower, also 33 pound-foot of torque. But that peak torque is delivered at 3.7 rather than 6,400, so halfway down the rev range, which that's going to make a big difference, isn't it?
Big difference. I mean, you know, I think it's really, excuse me, you know, those of us who've been in any way criticize the GT86, because I mean, I think it's a car that, you know, that people who get cars get and understand and love. But I think, you know, it was justly criticized for having this sort of slightly highly strung engine, or an engine that needed a lot of revs before it would do what it would do. And then when it did, it wasn't quite enough. You know, suddenly a 20% increase in capacity, more torque to develop right down the road range, really very little marginal increase in weight. It seems to me that this is a company that is listening. And what I find most interesting is my understanding is that the GT86 in financial terms was regarded as the most marginal of successes. It just about washed its face. And yet they still considered, despite the fact that they got the Supra and they've obviously got the GR Yaris, they still decided that it was sufficiently important to have that kind of car representing Toyota and the kind of brand that Toyota wants to be perceived as, to replace it. And then when they did replace it, they didn't do the usual thing, which was, you know, slap turbochargers on it, give it 400 horsepower, another 300 kilos of weight, and go, yee-haw, and look at these numbers. They've kept it light, and they've just thought carefully about what the limitations of the old car were and done what they can to address them. Now, you know, we haven't driven it, so who knows? It may be a shed. I doubt it. But yeah, really exciting that people are still, despite everything, despite all the pressures, are still making, you know, it's going to be a normally aspirated front engine, manual, rear drive coupe. You know, that's rocking horse rare these days.
Yeah, find another one of those.
Yeah. Well, I mean, above MX-5s, there are so few of them. It's a really, really, it's sort of, well, Ford Mustang, I guess. But yeah, I mean, as you said, just unbelievably rare, and I admire them even for doing it. So hopefully it'll be as good as it sounds. I don't know where we get to drive it. I don't imagine it'll be anytime soon, will it?
I don't know. But as you say, very much looking forward to it. And
yeah,
bravo Toyota for sticking with it. I think that's great.
Yeah.
Good. Okay, we'll leave that one there. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Rate and review the podcast, please. And remember to come back next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks. All the best.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Treat mom to healthy, glowing skin with Osea's limited edition skincare sets. Osea has been making clean, seaweed-infused products for nearly 30 years. Their Golden Glow body set includes 3 clinically proven bestsellers for smooth, glowing skin, while the Glow and Go facial set provides spa-level results at home. Both sets come in giftable boxes with savings up to $48 and free shipping for a limited time. For 10% off your first order site-wide, go to oseamalibu.com and use code MOM.